What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you're tuned into Kinda Neat. Thank you guys again for tuning in, as always. Like I said, we're back. It's fucking the second week of April now, and if everything is going smooth, then I will have announced that my album is available for pre-sale and that the date it's coming out is April 29th. If it's not going smooth, then ignore everything I just said. But I'm sure that everything is going to go smooth, and that's going to be the plan. First things first, at It's Intuition, follow me on Twitter. Follow my man, Ben Shin, behind the boards, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database, space with two S's. Follow us as a unit, at That's Kinda Neat, on Twitter. YouTube.com/That's Kinda Neat. We don't have a video this week, but that's okay. Go back and watch last week's episode with Anderson Paak, whereupon he murdered a song called Suede. And what else? Facebook.com/kindaneat. Facebook.com/itsintuition. I never shot that one out, but you can follow me on there too. I'm pretty active on it. Download the podcast app. Download the podcast app to your phone. Everybody asks me, wait, how do you listen to podcasts? You just go to the website? Nah, man. Download it on your phone, and then you can stream it whenever you're in your car. You can listen to it on your radio. You know, you can listen to it with headphones while you're at the gym. That's the easiest way. Download the podcast app. Subscribe to Kinda Neat. Rate us 5 stars. Leave a comment about who you want to see on the show, or just give Ben props for how buttery he makes it sound always. Just do that. Make your life easier. Like I just said, my album is finally ready. The duplication process has started. I've got a pre-order package available. Hopefully it's still available. I'm only going to limit it to 100, so they might already be sold out. If life is good, they're already sold out. But 100 packages where you can get a t-shirt, autographs, CD, a poster, a couple stickers, shipped right to your doorstep. So go order that. If not, order it on iTunes when it comes out. It's called Intuition and Equilibrium. It's just a self-titled record. It's the one we've been working on for 3 years now. And I'm sorry that it took so long, but we're really happy with how it came out. The artwork is cool. The stickers are cool. The posters are cool. I'm really happy with everything. And I'm very thankful for everyone that was involved with it. I'm glad you guys have been patiently waiting. And, you know, I appreciate it. And I hope you guys check it out. I don't want to make this too much about that, though, because I feel like we might be having a new audience tuning in today. And whenever we have a new audience tuning in, they're always like, oh, well, the interviewer is such a fucking douche. That's OK. You can fast forward past this part. When you hear a beat, that's when you know the interview is going to start. So anyhow, this week we have on Christian Clancy, one of the managers of Odd Future. And I've been a big fan of this dude. I've been a big fan of Odd Future in general. Just watching how they've blown up over the last 3 or 4 years has been amazing to watch from the outside. And the early days of Odd Future, watching them made me feel like I was a junior high kid falling in love with rap again, just because there was a certain energy to it and there was a certain punk rock aesthetic that just was exciting again. It made me feel, I know that they hate the comparison, but it made me feel like I was watching Wu-Tang again in seventh grade. You know what I mean? It was kind of this, you know, fuck everything attitude that was very refreshing. And in doing so, I think that they've kind of reinvented how the music industry works. They give away all their music for free. They sell shit tons of merch. You know, they mentioned it. They sell more in socks than most people sell in record sales. It's pretty crazy to watch. And so I've been wanting to do this interview for quite some time. I was actually right on the verge of getting an interview with him on Knock Steady back in the day before things went a different direction. And so I'm excited now to have him finally on the show and have a conversation with him. And it went great. He's a really cool dude. He's got a good aura about him. He's just kind of sagely and has, I think there's a lot that can be learned from watching people like him do the business that they do. And just even with how they treat people, I think, you know, there's something to be said for people that keep it really real. And I think in this conversation, you'll see that the dude keeps it super real, and I had a good time talking to him. So without further ado, I'm not going to make this intro too long because the interview ran really nice and long. This is my man Christian Clancy on Kinda Neat. Thank you guys for tuning in. Is it one of those?
Letting it go a little bit lately, but I recently had it trimmed today because I was getting a homeless vibe, yeah. And I had some real kind of stragglies.
Yeah.
So I've been getting my hair cut by the same guy for 15 years, every 2 weeks on a Tuesday, Jay Diola. And he gave me a nice little trim. I'm feeling it.
Yeah.
It looks go in and out of, you know, facial hair.
Is it one of those things where your daughter's never going to see your bare face?
You know, the longer you have a beard, the weirder you look without it,
yeah,
right?
For
like
sure.
It's like I've done that before, and like the thing with a beard is it makes your chin appear much further down than it actually is. So people have this concept of the mold of your face,
right?
And even you do, because you've looked at yourself with kind of this long chin, And when you're exposed to yourself beardless, it takes a minute.
You're like, where the fuck did I get
this overbite?
You look
in the mirror, like, I'm not a big mirror guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll look at myself for a good 20 minutes trying to figure out what's going on.
Right, right.
I'm probably not going to be beardless anytime soon. I like it. Plus, it also makes you appear wise.
It does.
Even though you don't need to be.
Right.
Your IQ goes up a little bit. If you wear it with a flannel,
yeah,
it really works.
You definitely have a wise man look going on today.
Yeah. It's all complete and utter bullshit.
Yeah. I was just out in Australia, and our kind of like liaison down there had this beard that he'd been working on for a year that was like down to his chest.
I respect that.
It was looking good, and it kind of inspired me, and I'm letting mine go too. So
I want to go. I don't know. I don't think my wife would be too into the Rick Rubin.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could do that. I
get impatient with it.
There's weird stages. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. But 15 years going to the same barber, you got a strong hairline still. Lucky you.
And I tell you, all this is hand done. He doesn't use
no buzz?
No shavers.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that looks buzz cut.
Nope.
Wow.
Nope.
That's
all hand done.
That's impressive.
My guy. I went one other place once, and I'll never do it again.
No shit.
Because I got the full on like Marine look thing, and nothing against the Marines. I just didn't want like the number two side with like didn't work.
Give him a shout out. Where's he at?
JD Ola, good form. He's epic. He's amazing.
There you go.
He cuts everyone's hair.
If you need your haircut.
He don't even need a shout out. Jay's killing it.
Yeah. How long
we have that barbershop banter too?
Nice.
Like you know, Jay knows everything. Jay's a wise man.
How long you been an Eagles fan, man?
My whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah, my whole life. I was born in Philly. I was actually born in Scranton, a couple hours out of Philly.
Yeah,
I moved to Philly
I
when I was five. Scranton's where the office.
Yeah, the office, exactly.
My
mom is from out in Easton, you know, Easton, Pennsylvania.
It's
right on the Jersey border.
Yeah, yeah.
So I grew up an Eagles fan back when like Randall Cunningham was the man.
He was awesome.
Yeah, I haven't followed football in quite a few years, but that was my team.
That's my sport. Like I life is busy enough, and then having a kid. I take sports off the rest of the year, but the Eagles I take dead fucking serious.
Yeah, I follow you on Twitter, and you get pretty intense with the Eagles tweets.
Yeah.
I fucks with it, though. It's good to have a passion outside of your other passions.
It's a release.
Yeah.
I think I've actually lined up in front of my television a few times. I get pretty into it, but I've learned that for a long time I used to let a loss affect me for an extended period of time. It would fuck my vibe up for 2 to 3 days post.
No shit.
Which is kind of weird and silly. And I had this kind of moment of clarity one day where I'm like, wait a minute. I don't play for the Philadelphia Eagles, right?
Yeah.
And I'm bummed on day three after what might have been a meaningless loss, right?
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? I'm going to cut that shit out and really just focus on when it's positive and then try to let the negative go. And it clicked.
That seems like a good route to go. I mean, at that point, you have to wonder if even the players are still bummed after three days.
No. Yeah, it's just this was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I do get pretty passionate. I just want one ring in my life. I'm 43 years old. I want one fucking ring.
It'd be nice.
I just want one ring. I don't want two rings. I don't want three rings. I want one ring. And I'm going to make myself a fucking ring, and I'm going to wear it because I deserve it just as much as any motherfucker on that team.
Take us to the promised land once.
One time.
Yeah,
I'm good.
That's
I'm not
great.
Greedy.
Born in Philly. How long did you stay there?
I left when I was 13.
What was Philly like back then?
Well, I moved to Arizona. It was the exact opposite of Arizona.
Yeah.
Philly
has a bad rep. Like, it's kind of dangerous nowadays. Was it like that back then?
Segregated, right?
Yeah.
I kind of lived right at the border between white and black. It was like, I lived on Lawrence Street, but I can't. I don't have the best memory in the world, but kind of right on the border where like it was the black neighborhood and the white neighborhood, and like very Irish Catholic, very church based neighborhoods were by parish as opposed to. But you know, the great thing about Philly was I had grown up being used to going to a place where all my friends were. No one had to hit each other. There was no iPhones or anything, but like everyone just went to this one area and hung all day.
What was
right?
the area about?
Sewell Street.
Yeah.
It was just a street near my house, and you'd go there and I'd have, you know, 30 friends, and that's where we...
Just like playing football and baseball and shit, hanging out?
Fucking off, hanging out, you know, sneaking cigarettes and sipping a beer now and again, being, you know, little rebellious kids,
and then
also playing spin the bottle and like stupid shit.
Of course.
And that's what I probably, you know, I had... I love that. I love that you could just wake up and go somewhere and you knew there was, like everyone was just, no one had to communicate. You just go there.
So it had like a small neighborhood vibe?
Yeah, but it was a rough, not rough, not rough relative to many standards, but it was definitely heading in the wrong direction. My mom went to get me out of there, which at the time I wasn't too hip on because I think I had just felt my first boob and I was super into that. And making the transition to Arizona.
Do you remember what the soundtrack was to feeling your first boob?
I don't think there's any music playing. I wouldn't have heard it. I was so fascinated.
I'm so proud.
Out.
I'm so proud of myself that the soundtrack to me feeling my first tit was Big Papa. I just think
amazing.
That's, right?
Amazing.
Couldn't do better for a soundtrack for that.
Amazing.
Yeah. So in West, yeah. Moore, in West
it was a head up the shirt boob. So it was a full like
wow.
Yeah, like whoa. More just in just amazed.
Yeah, that's
anyway.
Great.
So yeah, and so my mom moved to Arizona, 130 degrees.
Yeah,
completely different kind of lifestyle, way of living. In retrospect, mom, I love you. Amazing move, right move, 100%. Because I would have wound up just to doing something stupid. And I wasn't necessarily going the right direction. So, but at the time, I wasn't really feeling it.
Right, right.
You'd just
hit like seventh or eighth grade?
Eighth grade.
And then
I realized chicks liked my Philly accent because I had a really thick one, which wish I still had because it was really cool and Rocky-like.
Yeah.
And it's completely gone. But yeah, I mean, it worked out, I mean, it's just hot, so Arizona's fine.
Were your folks together when they moved or when you moved?
My folks got divorced when I was five.
When you were five, you keep in touch with your dad or no?
My dad's one of my best friends on the planet.
Oh, cool. That's great.
Not necessarily that we've had a tumultuous.
Yeah, of course.
I'm not without dad issues, but the dad issues have been resolved.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a blessing, right? Like
that
it usually doesn't happen and then you're left with that and,
Yeah, I'm going through that.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to deal with him.
Yeah, that's good.
And, my dad was. My dad's been sober for, a very long time, probably 25 years.
Uh-huh.
And he grew up kind of a party guy and completely flipped and has his life together and lives in Aspen. And,
oh, that's
he's awesome.
But is he from Philly too?
Yes.
Did he stay in Philly after you guys moved to Arizona?
My dad used to travel around a lot because he sold real estate. So
okay.
It was wherever the land was. There'd
yeah.
be like a tract of land, right? And then he was a really good salesman. So they would he would go to wherever the land was and sell it and party and make money and then go to the next place.
Do it up all over
again.
What did mom do?
My mom in Philly worked at a place called Stitches, which was just a retail store. She ran it. It was I think she did everything, like the buyer, my mom was tight. I had a cool mom. My parents went to Woodstock.
Oh, wow.
I was actually conceived close to Woodstock. I wish I could say I was somehow conceived at Woodstock because that would be so sick.
I wish that
could be like one of those white lie joints that you can get away with, but I can't because it's just not true and I'm a shit liar. But
right,
it was close.
Yeah.
It was close.
It was like the week after. They were still hungover from it.
And then my mom moved to Arizona. What did she do in Arizona? I don't remember what the job was in Arizona.
Yeah.
And then she worked at Disney. Then she moved to L.A., and then I followed suit. I wound up kind of having my own place, like almost my senior year of high school because my parents moved to California. I didn't want to leave my senior year.
Yeah.
I'm partying. I'm having a great time.
Right.
I think I had a girl at the time. Like I had no interest in changing for my senior year.
Yeah.
Right. Like that was the.
Why Arizona? Like what was out there?
She was seeing my stepdad,
who
she's been with forever, Greg. He's awesome, amazing. He was like a 60 Minutes producer that they actually met in Aspen and have this cool long history and have been together ever since. And they're actually the perfect couple. They're like just happy all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
that's dope that you have two positive male influences, man.
It's good. Absolutely.
I like when I hear the stories about I got a stepdad and he's awesome because most times people are like, oh, my stepdad is a fucking asshole.
I mean, they've both gone through their shit.
Of course.
I'm not saying perfection. None of us are. I mean, my dad he admittedly so. Again, I could talk about it because it's resolved.
Right.
But I know that my dad did the best he could at that time. And my stepdad had his moments.
Absolutely.
So
one of the first adjectives you used when we started talking was rebellious. You're like, we would go there to be rebellious. Was that something early on with you? Because I associate you with rebellious music in general.
Yeah, I think mostly, that stuff kind of becomes therapeutic. One of the biggest riffs against OF is that they're feeding aggression, but the truth is you're actually relieving aggression.
Releasing it, yeah, for
and
sure.
It's really perspective. And if you're not in it, you don't really understand that because it just looks like aggression, right?
Right.
But the truth is it's like therapy. So mm-hmm. for me, you know, again, I don't want to get too caught up on dad issues. Yeah. I had a lot of dad issues yeah. that I felt relief in aggressive music, but not because I wanted to sock somebody in the mouth. Just it was just like a release, you know.
Yeah.
Like, so
because you're polite all week and you need some time to let it out. Or
yeah.
something, you know,
everyone needs a little fuck you. It's,
yeah.
it's I think
yeah.
actually the people who don't, that's probably better. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I've always been attracted to aggressive stuff.
Yeah.
I like it. I like the energy.
Right. Right.
You know. I also listen to fucking James Taylor. You know, so I'm all over the place.
Right,
you know,
right.
I'm going through an Elton John thing right now.
Really?
But, you know, yeah.
Nice.
Hell yeah. So
nice.
I don't live in aggression for sure. I mean, my favorite artist is probably Fiona Apple.
Okay.
So I'm all over the place.
Yeah, for sure. Did you have hustles as a kid? Because I would imagine that you're a hard worker and that has to stem from something.
That I have hustles? Man, I wish I had a cool story, but I don't.
Yeah.
No hustles. I was just honestly, I was just trying to party.
Yeah.
I got my partying out very young.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wanted to party. Everything was focused around getting me to party.
What age was that starting? Already by the time you left?
13.
Really?
Yeah.
That's when the beers and the titties started coming out.
Yeah. I smoked more. My mom's going to hate this, you know, but yeah, it's not her fault in any way, shape, or form.
Put your earbuds on.
I just
on
moved
them.
To fucking Arizona. And,
yeah.
And the people I were meeting, this is what was going on. So I became a product of the environment.
Of course.
I probably smoked more pot when I was 13 than any year of my life. And Southern Comfort and Dr. Pepper.
Yeah.
And Mad Dog 2020.
Of course.
And Peppermint Schnapps and Everclear, which was a motherfucker.
Wow.
Yeah.
Everclear isn't so popular anymore, but I heard that back in the day, like, people used to cut holes out of a watermelon, pour in Everclear, let
yeah.
it sit in the fridge overnight, and then just eat that and get fucked.
Yeah.
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 That sounds like a good time.
It's a terrible drink. I mean, it burns, like, it's just terrible.
Like drinking yeah. rubbing alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you take to school at all, or were you just kind of like, the partying started, and you're like, fuck
did
school?
Did I take to school?
Were you into it?
Nah. I always kind of felt like I was much more into life experience, you know. Education's a weird thing, right? It's like
agreed.
Being told what to, you know. I just had this conversation today how, like, I have this conversation all the time, but, like, when I was growing up, it's like, here's what you learn, here's what you believe, and here's how your life's going to go. You're going to do this, you're going to go to college, you're going to marry, you're going to have two kids, you're going to, you know, and then past generations fucking have Google.
Yeah.
Right? And access to information and are at the tipping point of kind of challenging all that shit.
Right.
And saying, fuck, why? I don't need, you know,
mm-hmm.
we're learning this. Like, everything's at that weird spot. So did I take to school? No. It interfered with partying. There were classes I liked. I was interested in learning. It wasn't that I wasn't interested in learning. It's just that school – I was a class clown, class clown.
Right.
And I cheated constantly, and I hardly ever did homework. In fact, I don't actually remember doing homework in high school, but I wasn't stupid.
Right.
So yeah, bored.
Somebody who could get by with a wink and a smile a lot of the time.
I wanted to learn something else.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't understand why I'm learning all this. It's like it's just memorization.
What did you want to learn?
Shit. Great question, because it stumped me, because I basically would just part. I don't know. I would. What was I interested in back then? I was actually mostly interested in music.
Yeah,
to be honest with you, I loved guitar class.
Well,
you know,
here's a theory that I've been developing is, like, when I hear about people that are hard partiers that then go on to be successful business
mm-hmm.
people, I feel like what they're teaching themselves is really social relations. Because the more that I age and the more that I see my friends that are successful versus my friends that aren't,
mm-hmm.
it's the ones that have really fucking strong ties with people and are the guys that you'd want to go out and have a beer with. Those are
yeah.
the ones that seem to make the deals and be the movers and shakers. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think
to an extent,
it's all relationships.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and the ability to communicate and be honest. Like, I'm a guy who just, the authentic work is super played out and cheesy and cliche like, but if it's just so much easier. Life is so much easier that way.
Yeah.
You're just honest, and when you're honest, you wind up connecting with people because they like that, and then you get honesty out of them, and then you have a connection, and you're able to get shit done.
Yeah.
You're able to kind of tune into each other as far as ideas and stuff like that. Otherwise, it's about getting an agenda or someone getting over on you. I always
right.
try to approach all that type of stuff with kind of a common ground so you can build up, as opposed to – I get into weird psychology shit like that.
No, I'm so. Down. We got a lot of time to blow so you can get this weird
– No, I love that. Well, I love that stuff.
Yeah.
We all write in our own book, period,
uh-huh.
right? So it's like people are so much more in control than they think. It just matters how much their brain gets in the fucking way.
Right.
Right? Like
right.
You're just so much more in control than most people realize. But things like dad issues and stuff tend to cloud and
right.
Drugs or whatever the fuck else you got or whatever issue you got going on. And then there's different layers of that that get in the way of you actually just intuitively
right.
being.
Right.
Anyway.
Were you an athletic kid? Did you play sports in school if it wasn't academics?
I played intramural basketball and I was on the ski team.
On the ski team?
In Arizona.
Where is there
yes.
ski in Arizona?
We would go on trips to Colorado and compete.
Trouble in and of itself.
Absolutely. Lots of mushrooms.
Hell yeah.
Had some of my favorite times. Amazing. Fucking awesome.
In the woods out there.
Yeah, the best. The ski team was awesome. And I played intramural basketball. Our team was something relating to being stoners. And we were decent. Am I athletic? I played like flag football for like 8 years and played in a bunch of tournaments. Am I athletic? Yeah, a little bit.
Right.
Nothing to speak of.
Were you skating or anything like that back in the day?
No.
Yeah.
I can't skate for shit.
Yeah, same.
The culture is really cool, and I've always been interested. And I would be kind of the poser dude wearing the independent shirt that couldn't skate a lick. But, I like the way it looked.
But also, skate videos, beyond being amazing to watch, they always have the best music in them, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So many people come on the show and they're like, yeah, I got into skating, and that's how I got into music.
I've learned more about skating from these guys than I have
that.
Than anything. I
mean, right, right.
Skating to me was supreme, but I didn't skate. I just bought Supreme.
Right, right. Okay, so you're getting out of high school and mom moves to LA. You're already living on your own and
mm-hmm.
pretty much it sounds like you just like to party at that time.
Yep,
what
killing
were the
mullet.
What were the plans though?
Keep partying.
Yeah.
Mullet, truck with fucking 44-inch Mickey Thompson tires, roll bar, KC lights, Alpine system. Like white trash on acid.
You were really on some
killing
Arizona
it.
Shit.
Lived with a guy who was dealing some stuff. He had moved into that apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I got all this out of the way. I mean,
early.
It'll get positive. Typical bullshit, punching holes in walls, getting in fights, being stupid.
You must have been kind of hot shit at the high school having your own spot senior year or something. Like, did that become the congregation place?
I definitely wasn't hot shit in high school. I think I was just kind of cool with everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A chameleon of sorts?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't, I partied, but, our little clique of friends, I don't know what we were. I don't know. We were just kind of cool with everyone.
Right.
Yeah.
Then what, harder drugs come into play?
Yes.
Yeah.
Had a rough run in with coke for a couple years. Coke in my high school was everywhere.
Yeah.
It wasn't unique. It's not like to give perspective, like everyone did blow.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always promised myself I wouldn't do blow.
This is what, late 80s?
Yeah, 80 I was in high school 84 through 88.
So that's like the height of coke. Pretty much.
Coke was kicking then. Yeah.
Yeah.
I promised I would never do it. Because I'd just been around it too much in my life.
Yeah.
And I put a little thing called a nummy.
Your
gums.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I need more of this shit immediately.
That's the thing. I used to tell myself I would never do it too, but it's so much fun once you smell it that first time.
Yeah. The first couple times are amazing. And but it also for me became ultimately, again, I'm a chapter, not a book guy, so this happened to be a bad chapter,
yeah.
but is a good chapter because it needed to happen to get to the positive. But it helped me hit a dark place quick, it's, you know, cocaine's like Las Vegas. I mean, it's like, it's just, it's all ego. It's all me. It's all like you, your spirit just goes away. It's just all of, it's me and more. And, you know, so when you're doing it all every day, it's what led me to leave Arizona, cause I had to get out of the environment. And I moved to LA to be a rock star because I was playing guitar and I wasn't really that good. But when you do that much coke, it's you think you're
you
pretty
think
tight.
You sound amazing.
Yeah,
yeah.
I have not been around it since.
Yeah.
A little bit in LA, and then I dealt with all that, and then but haven't been around. I'm not a big cocaine fan.
Yeah.
I just know what it did to me.
It ruins people.
Yeah.
Oftentimes. So you pick up a guitar and you move to LA. Like, did you move in with your folks?
Yes.
Yeah? And did they see that there was some problems going on? Or what?
Yeah, probably. But I think my mom was still a little bit in the, you know, my mom went to Woodstock. So my mom probably looked at it from the standpoint that, yeah, he's going through shit. I hid everything. So it's like what she saw probably became more prevalent in my actions when I moved to L.A. And I went to the Guitar Institute of Technology. And was like planning on being a rock star.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of delusionally.
What do you learn at the Guitar Institute of Technology?
How to be Yngwie Malmsteen. That you probably have no idea who
that
is.
Nah.
He's like, he was this crazy guitar player that did shit really fast back then that everyone was trying to be. I was a hardcore Eddie Van Halen fan. Like, Van Halen for me was epic in high school. Like, fucking epic.
Yeah.
Van Halen, Iron Maiden, Metallica, Guns N' Roses. I was all in.
Yeah. Was that scene still going on Sunset when you got?
Yes.
Yeah.
Gazzari's, which was like the metal spot. Yeah, all that. And that Guitar Institute Technology wasn't the best place to go for someone trying to get off coke. Surprisingly enough.
Yeah, at that time.
And then I got deep into it again and then went away to deal with it.
Yeah.
And haven't seen it since.
Nice.
And stopped playing guitar.
Once you got clear-headed, you realize, like,
I think some of my shit got stolen.
Yeah.
And I just came to the realization that it just, that's not it.
Yeah.
I wish, because I was the guy who would sit in front of the mirror when I was a kid and sing Kiss songs and, like, Zeppelin 2, I think, was my first album, and I would air guitar, like, hardcore.
Right. When you're a kid, those people seem like gods, like particularly when you're out in the sticks, you know what I mean? And then you move to LA and you kind of realize, like, oh, wait, these are like human beings.
Yeah.
And you start seeing them around and shit. Like.
Yeah. I mean, most of my idols were kind of, you know, more in the music world than that and Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah.
That's it. I stuck to my lanes.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean?
So you go to Kick the Habit and then, like, do you have like a spiritual awakening when you're in there? Like, you come out with like a new, I don't know, like.
100%. Changed my life. Smartest thing I ever did.
Yeah.
I needed some structure and I needed some time to assess my life and where it was going and what I was doing and who the fuck am I. And you can't do that when you're cloudy headed. It doesn't happen. So I had a lot of quiet time and you work out. And I wanted to get the fuck out of there for the first 2 weeks. You know, you had to wear this kind of hospital robe thing. And I was constantly trying to figure out ways to get out and convince myself that this is silly and blah, blah, blah. And I stuck it out and it was probably the best thing I ever did because I needed that time to just, you know, shut my brain off.
Yeah.
You know?
So
when your brain's in control, you're fucked.
Uh-huh.
So
what do you rely on then? Your instinct, your gut?
I'm an intuition guy. Way different than gut. Gut has dad issues attached to it. Intuition is clean.
Okay.
Gut is George Bush.
Yeah.
Right? Intuition is clean with before any emotional, right? Because we all have reasons why we make decisions that are to protect our ego or fear, whatever the fuck it is. Again, I don't want to get deep, but I think that,
my rap name is Intuition. I'm about to sample all of that whole speech.
No, I think that's GPS. I mean, I think that's why meditation. I read something really cool the other day that someone said that, you know, they were referencing prayer versus meditation and what prayer was. And meditation was, you know, kind of listening to God, whatever your concept of God was, and then it pays out by strengthening your intuition. And it's like, that's really what it's all about. It's like, it gives you, when you meditate and calm your mind, it gives you the ability to understand what intuition even is because you're clean. Otherwise, you're just stuck in your head 24 hours a day.
Right.
Somewhere else.
Yeah.
Right?
Do you meditate a lot?
Not nearly enough. I do yoga. hot yoga, which I fucking love, and it's the single greatest thing in my as far as keeping myself healthy and in a good place. I would say yoga more than anything.
So wait, are you like besties with Russell Simmons? Like, it's
no,
because
no,
I
but he's in the same class a lot.
No,
I
mean, shit.
We've met a couple times.
I was gonna say I hear him talk about like meditation and hot yoga.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
He's a lot of times in the class.
No shit.
Yeah.
So when you come out of rehab, like, what's the – and you're back at the drawing board, like, what's the
– I went to – my family's in TV production. I went to work at just kind of various odd jobs. Mm-hmm. My uncle was a cameraman, and he shot various things, I would help him with sound. And the first job – I think it was the first job I did with him was to put a mic on Cindy Crawford upper shirt. And God, if you understand what that means for a kid at that time, and my hand was shaking like a motherfucker because you had to put the mic on, right? Cool random shit like that. I wound up editing for Primetime Live in 2020 because my uncle used to do the undercover work for these news shows, and I learned how to edit, and because it was just kind of in my family, right? And, you know, I'm making $60 an hour and clear-headed and, you know.
Wow. And this is at what, like 2021?
Something like that. Yeah. I went to Boulder somewhere in between all of this.
Yeah.
Which was another amazing experience. Boulder's one of my favorite places on the planet Earth. I think I became a man in Boulder because it got me out of L.A. and the L.A. kind of fucking thing.
Yeah.
And just because people just aren't caught up in Boulder. So it was – again, it helped my clarity. And then out of nowhere, I've always wanted to be in the record business. All my friends were in the record business. They were starting to be in – I just wanted to be in music. That's all I ever really wanted to
do. Well, how were your friends in the record business? Was it guys you met at the
Guitar
Institute?
I had a friend, Nino Cuccinello, who still works at Interscope in promotion. He's awesome. And we used to play basketball on the weekends, and he'd always show up. He'd be mad. I said, roll up with a wad of cash.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wasn't just the record business. It was the whole concept of it. And, like, a couple of my friends were working at Interscope, and I was editing. And one of my a good friend of mine that I don't see enough, Darren Wolf, I think got me an internship with Glenn at MCA Records. But at the same day, I was there. The head of country music, Diana Flaherty, was needed an assistant in the distribution arm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't give two fucks about country music. I respect it, but I couldn't tell you one goddamn thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to get in.
Right.
I didn't give a fuck what the job was, what you put. I'll wipe the fuck and take the trash out.
Yeah, at that point,
and I'll
no
walk
job
from
is
the
small.
$60 a week job just to intern, like I would have in a heartbeat. I just wanted the opportunity. And it worked out, and then I don't fucking know.
What was the distribution job like? Is it a lot of numbers?
I did like POP shit, so like which is like marketing materials that they put in record stores, and then we'd have these field staff that would go to the record store. This is back when this shit kind of mattered. It was such a different time where you'd put up posters in stores and have visibility campaigns and think of marketing campaigns, and because that's back when people were putting poster boards up and Steve Rifkin was starting like the street team thing and really being very smart with it. And then at some point I moved up a couple times of director of merchandising. I don't even fucking remember. Senior director of merchandising. Whatever way I can add on a little bit more loot once a year, they would change the title. And then I saw what Rifkin was doing, and I went into Jim Urey and Henry Droz, who's like this legendary guy. I think he's since passed. Amazing guy. And said, we need our own street department in the distribution arm, because the distribution worked with all the labels like Geffen, MCA, Interscope. And I said, I'll go write a manual and give me a week. I think I took a little bit of time off, and I'll propose it to you guys. And if you go for it, let me start this department.
Yeah.
And I did it, and they liked it, and I wrote it, and boom.
Wait, for some perspective for the younger kids, Steve Rifkin, well, he was with what, Loud?
He was with Loud. I didn't know Steve.
Yeah.
I knew his brother.
But you saw what he was doing. And he was doing that with like Wu-Tang, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I only know that because of the line, Steve Rifkin must have been sniffing to catch something so dope it left Monica Lynch's pussy dripping. Anyway,
yes.
So Steve Rifkin, was – he was like killing it and kind of changing the game with Wu-Tang, right?
Yes.
And how was he
doing
that?
And he started he understood how to market to the street. This was really before like the internet stuff. This is shit that make me sound old as fuck.
No.
But like it was before all that. So he figured out how to present how to market to the streets in the way the streets would respect it, right? It's like you can't just go into like, you know, that market to that demographic in a cheesy way or not feel authentic.
So he kinda
figured out how to do it and it worked and it became the platform. I mean, record labels were spending fucking, you know, $200,000 a campaign on fucking poster boards and then the fines to get the poster boards taken down and then put back up.
Yeah.
You know,
so he helped start like the Keep It Real movement,
kind of, a little bit. I suppose. I don't know.
That was a big thing at the time. Was keeping it real.
Yeah, I don't know.
So you saw what he was doing and said, "I want to fucking get into that."
Yeah,
shit.
It was interesting. We didn't have that, and I thought there'd be a cool way to tie that into what we were doing and pick priorities from each label, and they kind of let me and the labels pick the type of artists that we would have this street team work and try it out, and it worked. It was cool. It was fun.
What artists were they at that time?
Everything from the Cherry Poppin' Daddies.
Oh shit.
To Eminem's first album towards the end.
The Slim Shady LP?
Yeah. All the Cash Money shit.
Oh, okay.
Cash Money. I don't know what else. Shit.
When you're working in the industry on that side, I'm just curious, like, do you have to like really get into the music to want to push it, or is it kind of like you force yourself to do it regardless?
Yes.
Yeah.
And maybe this isn't the best attitude, but I've wanted a lot of leverage in picking the artists I worked with because inspiration's everything. Like if I'm not fired up about some shit, then when I talk about it to the street team kids, and they ain't going to be fired up. Like I don't want to be working shit that, you know, wasn't. And but I would learn to look at it with perspective. Like the Cherry Poppin' Daddies wasn't my thing.
I was just going to say, like,
thing. However, there was a lane.
Yeah.
For a hot second, there was a lane. So
right after Swingers came out.
Yes. I had to be, you know, I was trying to be more executive like and look at things not just as it was either a matter of being emotionally inspired or excited by the reality that there is a lane that I get to figure out. I love making water boil.
Yeah.
I fuck with that. Like that's my passion.
Yeah.
So it's not, sometimes the passion's about the band and sometimes it's about respecting the band, even though it may not be my thing, and then making the water boil.
Right, but seeing like this scene is bubbling and
that shit.
Yeah,
that's culture. Dope. It's like that. That's the shit that I've actually been – I'm mostly inspired. People that do culture shit, not the Science Project shit was always kind of boring.
So by that time, had you started building a team? Were you kind of like
– Yeah, I think I had like 40 reps
40
across
reps?
The country.
And
yeah.
you had 40 people under you.
Yeah, and we would have conference calls and all the time, and everyone would get their product, and we'd come up with campaigns and think of cool ways to do shit, listening parties, and, you know, all kinds of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. Where did it go from there? I don't do a lot of research for these, but I just know from like hearsay and word on the street that like you had a big role in like the Marshall Mathers LP.
Well, I went to 50 Cent. Yeah, I take that. Look, I basically Steve Berman and Paul Rosenberg, I would consider to be the two people I have learned and taken the most from as human beings, as executives, as people who push when they know when to push, people who can command respect, but you can also have a beer with, people who, understand how to play chess in the record business, how to, you know, it's like, so I had formed a relationship with Berman because I used to make the hype videos for Universal, which put all the hits from the year together for these fucking terrible conventions that were fucking boring as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
But I would make these pretty tight videos that made it seem really fucking sexy. Or at least I thought so.
Yeah.
And then Steve, Interscope never had product managers. Tom Wally wanted to start a product manager department. Steve said, "Tom, you should talk to Chris." I went and met with Tom at his house. One morning, I think I ate eggs. I think he had a chef that made me eggs, and I for all intents and purposes lied a lot, saying that I could because product management is kind of doing everything within a label.
What is product management?
You're the hub of everything. You're not doing everything. I don't want to take away anything else other people were doing,
right?
But you're responsible for having all the information, following it through, making some decisions, or making sure the decisions get made by those who need to make it. Like you are in the kind of the manager within the label.
Yeah. So you're talking to the promo people and making sure they're doing
their
job.
Yeah, and you run meetings and shit, which was super scary in the beginning at fucking Interscope. And this was right after like Death Row and stuff like that. Like, and they have these mammoth artists. And it was I had to learn so much. It's all the way down to the credits to the fucking CDs and the artwork and the fucking the copyright lines and all the way up to who's shooting the video and what's the budget and what's it, you know, all these things. It doesn't mean I was making all those decisions. What it means is I had to be abreast of and be on top of and be the point person for that information.
Yeah.
And I used to stay late as fuck and try to learn everything I can. I would try to ask people shit I didn't understand in a way that didn't make me feel like they would think I was stupid. And I just fucking sponged and sponged and sponged. And I was fortunate enough to – Marshall Mathers was one of the first records I worked. I also worked a Smash Mouth record.
Oh, yeah.
And then Marshall Mathers, I think Berman allowed that to happen. And that was fucking epic. That's where I met Paul. That's where I got to, you know – Paul and I have had a great relationship because I think we're like-minded in a lot of ways, and we would sit and riff and come up with cool ideas and do cool shit and and have fun with everything and kind of not – we would kind of like – you know, at the end, we would even like go away and like, you know, we'd go someplace far and sit in a room and like strategize and then just go back to the label and say, here, what we're going to do. And Berman trusted enough in us that in what we were doing, and then obviously M made fucking – ridiculous music, which made the whole thing, you know, without that, no matter what the fuck you do, works.
Right.
And, but I, you know, as far as being a huge part of stuff, I was a piece of a puzzle, got involved in Interscope at a fucking amazing time.
Did you stay at Interscope the whole time you were in the, like in the quote unquote industry or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah.
After Universal. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I've always heard of people in this in the industry like developing these teams and then kind of bouncing from label to label whenever the execs go or something.
Yeah, no, fuck that. Yeah. I like to have a group of, like, over the time. So I would product manage for a while, and then they moved me to run the marketing department, and then I would hire the product managers underneath and then oversee projects in general. And then
how's life feeling at that time? Were you
amazing? Because then 50 and G Unit and Game and Timberland and Dre and I mean, fuck, I mean, you know, 50 for okay, Marshall Mathers was epic as fuck. So 1.7 million the first week.
Yeah,
so
huge.
It was great for me in a lot of levels. One, whatever small role I did play, I did get to play. I formed a relationship with people I've never stopped.
Well, and the success probably validated your position in the
for sure. No,
company.
It all helped. Yeah. It all, you know. And then 50, and you know, 50 was like a fucking thunderstorm.
That was
like
crazy.
You know, epic. The perfect story within the club. So just if there was nothing else, he had this epic mob like story, and in the club.
Yeah,
I mean, even if that's all he had, he wins, right?
Mm-hmm.
I joke that we did this one poster where this is with my wife now, Kelly, where we did this kind of cinematic poster. He had the Gucci gun strap holder, and he's all pointing a gun, and it looks kind of in 3D. And I remember joking, saying, like, the story you have in the club and this picture, if you do nothing else, you're going to sell a bazillion albums.
Because
it was the coolest shit ever.
Yeah, I mean,
it was like a big punch in the face to every – it was awesome.
So how closely are you working with the artists at that point?
That time, it was my wife, Kelly, who is amazing and epic and, any success I've ever had, she's kind of been there, right? We've been a team for a long time.
Yeah.
Shaw Money XL was 50's guy back then in the beginning, before Lighty came on board. And one of my favorite people on the planet Earth. Shaw's energy was amazing. He got it. He was part of the movement. Like, it was so great to have someone that understood. When people know – I love artists that know who they are. It's not a fear thing. It's not like, what do I got to do to be famous? What do I got to do? What producer? What hook? What this? That's a business, but that shit bore the fuck out of me.
Right.
But for guys that come in with the confidence and the – And that is so inspiring. Like, you sit there and riff, and we used to sit and riff about everything, every move that was made. Like, it's not like I was making the decisions, but we would make it as a team. Like, right. Myself, Shaw, eventually Lighty. Actually, Lighty came in with Shaw. I don't – it was like a co-thing. I don't remember the exact logistics of it. But Lighty, Shaw, and I was – so I had Chris Lighty, Paul Rosenberg. I was doing Limp Bizkit at the time, which I don't care what anyone fucking says. For a moment, they were murdering it.
Hey, I bleached my hair when I was a senior in high school.
Murdering it.
Because of Fred.
Fucking murdering it. So I had Jeff Quantins and Peter Katsas. I had – you know, I was learning from the best – fucking people in the business that were building movements, right? That was based on culture. Like, when, you know, like all that, like what M was doing, what 50 was doing, what Game was doing on the West Coast, you know, it was, and Bubba Sparks, random, but a fucking amazing guy.
Hey, Deliverance, you know, is a great album.
Amazing
too.
Album. Yeah. Underrated, probably misunderstood before his time, whatever the fuck the answer is. Love him. I've eaten 8,000 pounds of steak with that dude in Athens, Georgia, and at Balboa on Sunset, the old Balboa.
Yeah.
And he practically lived at my house.
Nice.
My whole thing was the relationship with the artist. Like, I always want it to be. I was in it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
So, and I'm a big passion guy. So I was so fortunate enough to be able to sort of pick and choose who I worked with, sort of.
Yeah.
And then build relationships of trust where we can just have fun with all of it. Because if you're having fun, you win.
Correct me if I'm wrong. So it sounds kind of like the music was there, and then after the music's there, you guys collaborate on, like, how are we going to present this to the people? That's what the job was.
Yeah. The marketing side was just like you're basically in charge of the budget.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. You got, you know, where we at on, you know, back – this was a different time. There's a lot more money spent. Music video back then,
$800K.
100%. No, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, all the time.
Wow.
Hype Williams, are you kidding?
Yeah, those are huge videos.
And, you know, 50, you know, these, they were making the money, so,
yeah,
you know, they got the money.
Yeah. So when you say that you and Kelly have been a team for a long time, how did you guys meet? Where did you guys meet?
Okay, I apologize, Kelly. I was in my office one day. She was out of college finishing college, working part-time in the sales department. She walked by my office one day. I was on a conference call. I said, hold the fuck on. I put that shit on hold. I walked out. I looked at her, and I was like, whoa. And I'm not that – I was never that dude. Like, I'm not like the fucking – I'm not implying that I have any sort of game whatsoever.
Right, right.
But I was like, goddamn. And then I wound up spending a bunch of time in the sales department. I never went to the sales department because they got like pie charts and they analyze and shit that I'm not trying to fuck with. I like making water boil. At that point, I'm like, I just want to make water boil.
Yeah.
You guys figure out the number part of it. I wound up hanging up there around a lot, and then we actually became really good friends for a very long time, which was probably a catalyst to why we're still together. Like, we got to know each other. She knew my shit. She's seen me, you know, go in and out of relationships. And she's seen me with some dark relationships.
Uh-huh.
And she, I guess, got to really see the real me. So then we're working in the same department. I started to have feelings. I couldn't hide the shit anymore. I wasn't the type of dude to hook up with girls in the office at all, and she wasn't the type of dude to hook up with guys in the office. So it was like it was a unique situation. The feelings were real. I wrote her – this is so cheesy. I wrote her a note.
That's great.
No, wait. I said we got to go to lunch. I wrote her a note. We went and I sat down and I went to go order food or something. I said, read this. And it was basically along the lines of, without giving away, without her getting mad at me, like, you know, let's try a date.
Yeah, yeah.
If it don't fucking work, fuck it.
Yeah.
But I'm feeling like I got feelings and, you know, I'll be mad at myself if we didn't try.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't work, so what? We're friends. Who gives a shit?
Right.
And we went out on a date and I probably liked the first date more than she did, I think, by her telling it, which kind of bums me out a little bit. Maybe my first impression wasn't so tight.
It was a Bon Jovi concert?
No. It was Sushi Roku in Santa Monica.
Nice.
And And I don't know. I mean, it took time. It was awkward. We worked together. This whole thing.
I mean, did you guys have to keep it under wraps in the office for a while?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you don't, you know, more protective of her. You don't want to be seen as that because she wasn't
absolutely.
She wasn't that at all.
So right. You know, yeah.
And also, and no bullshit, protective of me. I don't want to be the dude, you know, that guy either. Like, it's just not my thing. I was never really the kind of that type of dude.
So you guys are working in the same department and we're working on projects together at that point?
Yes.
Nice.
She, every big record I worked on at Interscope, Kelly was a part of. She left at some point, so towards the end, no, but every big record, she was as much a part of what I did as anything because she basically, you know, she in the beginning especially, was the one who actually had to get the shit done.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
So in the heyday of the stuff at Interscope, when you're doing the M's and the 50s and the G unit, like, I would imagine everything's like feeling great. You're riding high on life.
Fucking amazing. But killing it.
So when does it get to the point where you're like, oh, this doesn't work for me anymore?
I don't know what year it was. I'm really not the best with timelines.
And like not naming names or groups or anything like that that had anything to do with it, but like it just
got the moment it happened. The truth is that I started to just burn out because of the politics of it all. And again, I have incredible relationships with people at Interscope, people that I will be friends with for life. Steve Berman's my mentor. Jimmy Iovine's a fucking genius.
Yeah.
Obviously. And but I burn out. The business had shifted. You know, Interscope in the beginning. Think about Interscope in the beginning. Marilyn Manson, Eminem, you know, towards the beginning. Yeah. Death Row Records. Yeah. No Doubt, right? At that time, everything was culture and it was in front of. It wasn't chasing. It was in front of. And it was building these kind of – and I got to learn and sponge that shit in. Like Interscope Records was affecting culture in like seven different lanes. That shit was amazing. Not that they still don't. And they, like, I'm kind of removed from the record business a little bit, ironically. So I'm not speaking on anything current. But the vibe just started to change. It started to feel more pressure, more fear based, and more like making quarters and more like just shit. I'm not, you know. And what happened was I started to burn out. I had a realization that I was taking a check. And the check was great. You get stuck in those jobs sometimes because the check's great. And I thought, well, if I leave, what am I going to do without that check? And I just realized I had burnt out. And there was something that I was supposed to do with an artist that I had to talk an artist into. In my gut, intuition, felt just not something – it's just not right. It wasn't right. And I had never done it before because I had established kind of trust relationships. And I did it. And I hung up the phone and I had like this sort of cheesy movie moment where I got up and I shut my door and I sat down and I said, I'm fucking done. Like I just became the guy I never want to become.
No shit.
And basically what happened was it became painfully obvious that I wasn't happy anymore.
Were you a workaholic at this time too? Like were you working all crazy hours at night?
Nonstop.
Yeah.
I was burnout.
Yeah.
Really burn out because at that time we didn't have enough product managers, so I was responsible for like there'd be like fucking 18 records in cycle. So it was like it's you know trying to be everything to everyone and have all this information in my fucking head. Like I was burnt, I was politically spent, and I wanted to go hike the Himalayas. I say the same fucking thing every time, but like that's I literally wanted to. I wanted to go hang out with Monk. I wanted to chill the fuck out.
Yeah,
because I wanted to regain my love for music. I wanted to because I lost that. Music became a product. And that's a bummer because music was my whole life.
It becomes numbers instead of notes.
It's the one thing that like fucks with me. And I lost that. And, you know, without – again, sounding cheesy. You kind of lose a piece of yourself. And when I realized that, I was – and they knew I wasn't happy. And we kind of went through this thing. And there were cuts being made. And it was a simple kind of thing and no hard feelings. And I bounced.
Yeah.
But it was 10 years. So it was an incredible run. I seen the world. I hung out with the fucking biggest stars. My favorite, like, fuck.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Wouldn't change one thing.
Yeah. You know? During the fucking peak of the label. Like,
so epic.
So you walk in and the next day, is it kind of just like, okay, I think I'm done? Like, or like,
it was a process, but yeah. It just started that feeling didn't leave.
Yeah.
So I just – it became obvious I wasn't happy and probably was loose with my lips in certain situations. Start looking like you don't give a shit and you kind of – you know, it's like – you know, the ebbs and flows of life.
Absolutely.
I was – you know.
So after you leave, what do you do? How did you reset yourself?
Well, I left and kept working for some of the artists that I had been working for, except they paid me instead of the label. So I kept working M, I kept working Game, I kept like – it's almost like my job didn't change because I still came in and ran the marketing shit and still had to run the meetings, but I wasn't working in Interscope, which was kind of cool because now I'm working for the really the good guy ultimately. Not that Interscope's the bad guy, but in the, you know, in the hero villain narrative.
And is it a thing where when you do that and you go freelance, now you're making more money than you were at the label if you're getting paid directly from the artist?
Depends.
Yeah.
Depends on how many artists you're working. But yeah, no, the money was fine.
Yeah.
And I don't know. A friend of mine, Dave, sent me, I think it was French and Earl videos. And I was burnout still. I was doing my job. It felt a little better.
Yeah.
But I was still stuck in the system. I'm on the other side, but I still got to walk in the system and play this game and fucking say the same fucking shit in the same meetings with the 10 check boxes that you got to check because the gatekeepers, it's like boring as fuck.
So you never completely escaped it before you found out about OF?
Correct.
Oh, okay. I had this image of like you actually going to the Himalayas.
I did not. Growing the beard out. I never made it to the Himalayas.
So you were still in LA doing your thing, and then Dave, that's Dave Arudi?
Dave Arati, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Arati, sorry.
He worked in business development at Interscope. He sent me those videos. He's like, check these out. And I thought they were amazing, but I was still so caught up in myself. And, you know, but I knew – I always hate when people talk about this type of shit because it always sounds so kind of fucking just lame. But, like, it was obvious something cool was happening.
Right.
I was super busy with them. But at night I would, like look shit up and, like, you kept digging and digging. It's like, you know
– Yeah. I remember seeing those videos and, like, as you – just those two vids. Like, you can see all the same faces in them and then you find their fucking Tumblr and then you find this other thing. And all of a sudden you're like – whoa, what the fuck? Like, these kids have a whole little world going on already. And that was
a whole fucking world.
That must have been, I remember it very specifically. It was like March of 2010 when I saw the Earl video, right? And yeah, it was mind blowing. I couldn't believe that I was a 16-year-old.
Epic. And so we kept digging and peeling back the layers of the onion. It kept going. And they, you know, you realize that not only are they making this kind of movement thing happen, but they're doing it all themselves and they don't give a fuck what other people think. And I thought that was so fucking cool. Like, everyone at that time in music was like, I need this perfect beat. I need this producer. I need, like, look like this, wear this leather jacket, put the Scarface poster above your fucking back. Every rapper, I knew what fucking their favorite movie was Scarface. You knew what kind of cars they had. They had the same chicks in the videos and the fucking story was boring as fuck because 50 had the sickest one.
Yeah.
So everything else was like, whatever. All right, you're a gangster, you're this, you're that. It's like, so it needed to either reinvent itself in some way. It was just, it felt like hair metal went back in the day when Nirvana came out. So it was just this bowlish soup of just the same shit. And they were interesting. These guys were punk rock. They were fuck you. And I was, fuck, I love fuck you. Right. So, like, I'm a Rage Against the Machine guy. So we met with them and, there were other people interested in them at that time. We had a bunch of back and forths. We met various, donut shops or wherever the fuck we met.
Yeah.
They wound up working with us, and the rest was fucking awesome.
Do you remember, like, roughly the month that you were meeting with them?
Absolutely not.
And I asked that because I always hear all these conspiracy theorists talking about, like, oh, no, they've been tied into the industry since, like, those kids were, like, 15 and da-da-da-da-da. And, like, they were –
absolutely not in any way, shape, or fucking form. These were kids that were literally taking the bus to meet – from all parts of the fucking city, taking the bus to meet each – it's some universe shit.
Yeah.
It's some fucking universe shit. Like, the fact that this group of kids got together the way they did is you know, I'm a weird universe guy. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that it was not. No one was helping shit.
Right.
I remember that stuff. Like, it's, they're already signed to some label who's kind of bankrolling.
Right. Right.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Yeah. The Earl video, I was like, that really hooked me because I'm an older hip hop head, and that was like shit that reminded me of like 1993. All of a sudden, I was like, whoa.
Well, when we met with them, he was about to go away, so I had not met Earl through the whole process until he came home.
Really?
Yeah, he was a mythical figure to me. Yeah. But I felt like I kind of knew him. Now, I didn't, but I felt like I knew the concept of him.
Yeah.
Which turned out to be some true, some false, but we all create movies in our heads of what we think who people are. But
right.
And you learn along the way. But yeah. It's the greatest story
when you
ever.
When you meet the guys, is it instant click? Did they trust you?
Not right away. Hell no.
It seems like they don't trust anybody at first, right?
No.
So
you have to earn that. They're not. I mean, at best, we had a good meeting.
Yeah.
I don't think any of them were like, "Oh my God!" That, you know, I don't think I'd have to ask them, but I don't think anyone, you know. But we chased them, you know, not in a thirsty way because I'm not a chaser. Again, if things are supposed to be, they're supposed to be.
Right.
And it kept digging, like, you know, Haji and fucking Damo and Sid. Like, Sid in the meeting, I'm like, whoa, there's this chick who's the engineer and she's this charismatic, like what the – this is fucking cool.
Yeah, they had a lot of puzzle pieces together.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many. It was like – it just kept going and going, and they did everything themselves and they didn't give a fuck. And like that was – there was no not giving a fuck at that time in music.
Right.
And what does a kid at 14 through fucking 18 want to hear? Not giving a fuck.
Right.
Challenging stuff. It's like that's where you find yourself.
The – on the nose thing to do is like people would assume that you would just go into meetings with them and be like, oh, hey, you guys are really cool and I have like this plan for you. And I would imagine like maybe you went counterclockwise to that and like just kind of vibed with them or something, like didn't pitch any plans for
no,
a while.
I'm not, again, for better or worse, it depends on perspective. I'm not a big like, hey, sign here type guy. Because I grew up around that in the business. Like I that's what I was burnt out on, the business side of stuff.
Right.
If I want to work with someone, it's because we vibe and there's a thing that's of inspiration and there is a trust. You got to gain trust with these kids. I mean, a lot of these kids are fatherless. A lot of these kids, like, there's a lot of stuff that comes with it. And I didn't want to be that. I never want to be that guy or perceived as that. I'd rather not sign them than be perceived as that guy.
As like a salesman.
Yeah, no, it was more vibe, and we just kept digging, and it kept getting more interesting and kept talking. And it was born out of a relationship and then a decision. It wasn't born out of a pitch.
Yeah, yeah.
So I probably pitched a little bit, but not. I wasn't overdoing it.
So when the guys settle on you as a manager, then what does the role become? Like, how did you come up with the – I look at Odd Future now as like a brand – that happens to have some music. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I agree.
And to me, that's awesome because
amazing.
Incredible, and rare.
I
mean, the fact that you guys' clothing line isn't fucking band t-shirts. It's like a real fucking clothing line.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I would imagine that you foresaw all that.
Yeah, absolutely. Very strategic.
Yeah.
First it was myself and Dave was kind of the business guy who very smart, Harvard. Well, he didn't go to Harvard. He went somewhere else. One of them fucking smart schools.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we knew that we had to do something different. And because they were so different, they didn't care. And it was such an opportunity to kind of, first establish trust through the fact that we actually really give a shit and this is fun and let's go fuck with everyone. Let's go have fun. Like, let's make this be what it can be, because just taking them to a major label would have been a fucking disaster. They don't give a fuck about it, working with this producer or writing this hook or fuck. They would have said,
right,
go fuck yourself.
Right.
It wouldn't have worked. So it had to be something that they owned. And the concept was to start their own label, sign them to their own label, and then do the label deal. So they actually own the label they're signed on. And it was just kind of a smart thing. And we were going back and forth with various labels. And I don't want to say too much, but like there's a game you play where, you know, you want to make it about ego.
Uh-huh.
And when you make it about ego, you can get much, much better deals because someone wants to win. And it just so happened that Daniel Smith, who's Elliot Wilson's wife and used to be the editor of Billboard magazine, ran a story. I think it was the week we were starting to narrow down what we were going to do.
Uh-huh.
And the cover had the guys on the cover and it said the future of the record business.
I remember seeing
and
that.
And I'm like, fucking A, this is awesome.
That just starts
the
crazy
price just went
one.
Up, right?
Yeah,
so it's like, And it was a great article. And because it was, for, you know, in a lot of ways, these guys have changed shit. So it actually has played itself out to some extent by the rearranging of what the metrics of success are.
Yeah.
Right? There's a
yeah.
better margin in a sock than there is in a CD.
Yeah.
But it's still inspired by the music. So what the fuck's the difference?
Right, right. That's what I was going to say. It seems so scary to put out music for free when you've been around making money off of music for so yeah. long. I would imagine that has to be a big leap off of a cliff to go like, okay, let's fucking try this and put all the music out for free and we'll just sell clothes and t-shirts and shit. You
yeah.
know?
Well, but also, I mean, and that was driven by those guys.
Because they were already doing that.
Brilliantly already. I think they had put out probably 8 to 10 at that point. My memory.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were training kids not to buy music. So you got to be, you know, it's like, for me, with them, it was always about culture. And it wasn't just about culture. The Odd Future was bigger than the band itself. Odd Future represented kids growing up wholly on the internet with access to an unbelievable amount of information who were tired of seeing what they were seeing. They were looking at us adults going, you guys sit around and bitch about fucking religion and gay marriage and fucking politics. You
yeah.
shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And – you know, challenging everything, and they were so down to challenge the system in every way that we were able to kind of steer and drive, and we had the leverage for multiple reasons because it felt so exciting, and people realized there was a talent, and it was deeper than, you know, and everyone wanted to be a part of that. So it kind of, you know, it panned out in the perfect way,
mm-hmm.
literally perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So
what is it about Tyler that makes him such a charismatic four figure for the group? And I ask that because it seems like one of the conspiracy theories about the whole, like, oh, they were being courted by labels forever, was there's this article about his high school that he was going to. I don't know if you ever saw that. It's like an old LA Times thing where they happen to mention this kid Tyler who had this whole concept of a magazine. Have you seen this article?
Yeah, no, true.
To me, that just speaks to volumes to the fact that, like, he was that magnetic even at a young age.
Tyler is Tyler's a fucking, again, a cliche, stupid. Tyler's a visionary type dude. The reason why he is what he is because of intelligence and awareness, and they're mm-hmm. two different things. He's smart in the way he needs to be smart, but he's aware, which is actually real intelligence. He's aware. He understands his environment around him and what game he's playing and how he's playing it, and he's very, very smart at chess. He's got his own way of doing it, and he knows you lose 30% of people through it being offensive or whatever it is. But Tyler is an incredibly smart kid.
Mm-hmm.
Look, he's a kid who doesn't drink or smoke. He's a kid who you can't do just about Tyler. Like, the truth is, the beauty of OF was there were each one was its own character. Tyler is nothing like Left Brain. Left Brain is nothing like Sid. Sid is nothing like Mike. Mike is nothing like Damo. Yet it's a family.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of, again, like on some universe shit, like this weird collective of kids that you wouldn't think hang out. And usually in hip hop kind of cliques and all that, you got your one main dude and he runs the shit, and you got your people around him.
Mm-hmm. The weed carriers or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Or whatever. The rappers you don't really want to listen to, but they wind up getting some sort of album.
Right.
But he's the kid who drew the donut on his shorts in fucking high school and had the vision for a magazine and had this idea. And Tyler's the type of guy that sees things into fruition. And again, it's another thing that most people don't understand they have the capacity to do if they got out of their fucking head a little bit and wrote their own book. But the seeing things into fruition, he draws something on a piece of paper and then he sees it in a month, whether it's a shirt or whether it's a video or whether it's whatever, or whether it's a magazine when he was a kid that he'll probably get around to doing at some point or whatever, you know, or what. He just sees it. And when you see it, you just kind of allow yourself to do it. And my job is to play chess with that, because you got to fit that kind of brilliance into a non-brilliant industry,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Who aren't necessarily ready for change no matter what it is, and be willing to challenge things and have fun with that. And I'm a fucking marketing guy, so we riff all the time. But mm-hmm. you know, like all the guys, it's like there's so much to OF. When, you know, it's like you have all these kind of factions and the internet. Like, Sid's a fucking rock star, mm-hmm. right? You know, they're touring now and doing very well. And it's, you know, you can feel that kind of trajectory type thing happening, which is amazing. Tyler's he's brilliant. And he's got a heart of gold.
Well, and he's a,
he gives a shit.
It sounds like he's a finisher, too. Like, everybody's got ideas, but no one takes the time to actually finish them.
He's an – well, and what's amazing about him is he's an incredible pivoter. Like, he just – he can have – if something goes wrong, he can fucking pivot. He may go – he'll go, fuck. Let it go, pivot, keep it moving, right? As opposed to getting stuck in, fuck. And then again, you're writing your own book, you get stuck and fucked, then the next couple months are going to suck.
Yeah, right?
But if you pivot and say, okay, how do I use this as a fuck? Like, but he seems to naturally know how to weave that. And that's intelligence to me. That's real intelligence. Fuck all the school shit.
Right. Going back, one thing I found interesting, you said one of the things that really turned you on to the industry initially was what you – or like getting into the product management was like seeing what Rifkin did with Wu-Tang. How did you feel when people started like comparing OF to like the new Wu-Tang?
They weren't crazy about it because they didn't want to be compared to anyone. It had nothing to do with being compared to Wu-Tang. Is that being a negative? It's obviously a fucking positive.
Right.
I totally understood it because it's a collective of people who have individual personality. Like, to not see the correlation is silly.
Right.
They would get a little riffed on it. Again, not against Wu-Tang, just because they, you know, it was like they were them.
And they were the
same way Wu-Tang wouldn't want to have been whoever the fuck was before them. Like, if this was reversed, it would be the same thing. So it wasn't negative. It was just like, nah, we're today. Like, we represent, you know, kids who have, you know, it's a different game, although there's phenomenal similarities.
But did a part of you know that you were doing with them what Rifkin did with Wu-Tang? Were you aware, like, how
the
tides were shifting?
Of course. Yeah. And I've studied that shit. Like, I you know, and I take what I like and I disregard what I don't. And I, you know, I like to sponge, man. I want to learn. I've had the best teachers. I mean, you couldn't assemble a better fucking – I'm a fortunate motherfucker. I got to go to Harvard for the record business, right? And the positive and the negative and the bullshit and the real and the so – literally. I mean, I went to Harvard. Very, very fortunate on that. And what the similarities were obvious. And even the way it was spreading was obvious. It was in a different way, but, you know, word of mouth. And like Odd Future broke like a rock band, right? And to me, the most important thing for us to do was to fucking tour. Because live, they were fucking crazy. And we didn't need a big production. And we can do it for cheap because it was about the personalities and it can feel different. I mean, Tyler could be fucking Iggy Pop, right? Wherever the fuck. And Haji looks like his head's going to explode on stage. There was so much energy and left brain with his fucking being fucking left brain. And Damo and Mike and fucking all, you know, all these – and Sid DJ in the beginning was fucking epic, right? So it's like there was all these incredible personalities. Take this fucking thing around the world. Let's get the world to pay attention because this is starting to feel too hypey. And when shit's hypey, that means it's going to die.
Right.
But if I take this group around the – not me, but if we as a team, we take this group around the world and show them how fucking they can emotionally connect with audiences, when that 15 minutes happens, those fans are going to say, no, fuck you. They're fucking amazing.
Yeah, that's –
so that was kind of strategically – trying to – because hip-hop doesn't work in every country. There's a lot of rappers in the U.S. that can't tour fucking Oslo, Norway. I mean, yeah, you go to play the festivals, but they can't go do a show. Like, you know, and for me, I knew – I wasn't sitting on in the club. I wasn't sitting on in my name of. I wasn't sitting on, you know.
Yeah, they don't have hits. They just have a strong, consistent records.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Radio will adapt to them at some point.
Yeah.
It'll happen.
I mean, I would give you much kudos because I do think that, like, you guys have managed to establish a lifelong fan base. I think these are kids that aren't going to – like, you know, sometimes you get into a band when you're a teenager and then you're embarrassed that you were into that band.
Yeah.
I feel like these are guys who, like, they wrote – you guys have –
do you have one?
Me? Well, Limp Bizkit's probably one of them, yeah.
See, I don't hate on Limp Bizkit, but I feel you.
You know what I'm saying?
100%.
Well, like, you got to understand.
But
with the Limp
Bizkit –
damn,
Significant Other and $3 Bill Yard are epic.
This is a dirty secret of mine, but my junior year of high school and my baseball hat, I used to always write lyrics to get me hyped up on the inside of my baseball cap. And, and one of them was Fred Durst's song. I think it was like Break Shit or something.
Yeah,
I wrote it.
Amazing.
So, you know, but – What I was getting at is that, like, you guys seem to have ridden the hype machine far enough to now you have a fucking fan base that's going to follow you forever. You know what I mean? Like, there is no –
Yeah, knock on wood. I feel like – yeah, again, I feel like the group is bigger than – they represent a tipping point, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Without going to, as another thing I'm saying too much lately, but it's true. I don't give a fuck what you're talking about. Food, government, entertainment, in any aspect of entertainment, music, film, whatever, retail of any kind.
Yeah.
All of it's at a tipping point. All of it. Every fuck, what we're doing, everything is at a fucking tipping point. Old money versus new money, right? And the old money's got plenty of it, so they spend to do whatever it takes to manipulate to keep the fucking shit from changing because they're making too much cash and they're tired and they want to go to fucking sleep.
Right.
The young cats are trying to come up and do shit their own way, and it's hard because you're fighting against a system that doesn't want you to win because it means they have to adjust, right? Even Odd Future in general. Odd Future, if you're still rocking in a Nietzsche velour sweatsuit, you don't want Odd Future to succeed because it means you got to flip your cool because you're now uncool.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So our thing and the group's thing was take this fucking thing to the fuck the gatekeepers, fuck all that. Go take this fucking thing that feels so epic and kind of important and take it to kids. They'll do it for you. And it's like a rock band. It's how rock bands used to get broke. So they seem to have much more in common with that than they did of any sort of fucking record label bullshit game that you got to go play that once you get in that fucking wheel, you can't get out of.
Right.
Had no interest in trying to do the radio thing. It's like, fuck that. Yeah. I don't give a fuck what the DJ and bum fuck thinks.
Yeah.
If he likes it, he plays it. If he does, I don't want him to play it if he don't like it.
Right, right.
And, so whatever.
Winding down, I have a couple more questions. I could talk about this shit all day, but okay. One of the times that I kind of noticed, as you talk about the tipping point, the thing where I really started to see the water bubble for everything was it Jimmy Fallon?
Epic day.
Like, dude.
Epic day.
Actually, there was two of those right around the same time because he released the video where he hanged himself at the end. What is that?
Yonkers.
Yonkers.
Epic.
And then Jimmy Fallon,
epic.
Man, I remember, actually, I felt like a fucking little kid.
Yeah,
like,
we all did.
Watching it, it was the same feeling that I used to get when I would wait for Wu-Tang videos to come on in seventh grade. I stayed up late to, watch the video release.
So rare.
Those things were, really – I was like, wow, they're really solidifying themselves. What was it like to watch that from the side of the stage at
fucking
Fallon?
Epic. Unbelievable. Yeah. Perfect moment in time.
Yeah.
My favorite moment is Tyler jumping on his back, not because him on his back, but the look in his eyes because Tyler – the thing I am most jealous of Tyler is that he's never lost his seven-year-old.
Yeah.
And you see it in moments.
Yeah.
He's never lost – he's done what we all really want to do. We all want to fucking be our seven-year-old for a decent part of the day. It'd be fucking nice, right?
Yeah,
it's like – he has, and you can see it in his eye. He lives it. He'll show it to you. And that moment, him and Haji murdered it. The most F thing at the end. It was it was fucking perfect.
Yeah, it was so crazy.
And all these things kind of kept happening. And and the truth is, on top of that, on top of all this craziness, out of left field, you got fucking Frank Ocean, who's what the fuck, right? On some shit that no one's on and doing the same thing in a different kind of, style. You had all these things coming at the same time where it was just – you couldn't have timed, worked. It's one of the crazy – and Earl coming home and all these one of the craziest stories in the history of music.
Yeah.
I don't give a fuck where you stand. If you really break it down and with Earl and Frank and Tyler and – all the guys and what they're doing and the TV shows and this and traveling the world and then Earl coming home and what that means and his friends are fucking famous and he's what the fuck and dude, it's the greatest story ever.
Well, that brings me into one of my other questions I wanted to ask. Earl gets home and all of his friends are fucking famous and here's this dude Chris that's helping out and Dave that's helping out. How does he just kind of trust you guys because his friends tell you to, or
that was a whole long process.
Yeah.
And out of respect to those who it was just a process that needed to happen.
Yeah.
And I was never about – I think the world kind of works things out on its own if you get out of its way. And I feel what I do know that Earl had a phenomenal opportunity. You want to talk about a setup. I thought Tony Yayo had a great setup coming out of jail.
Yeah.
Earl had this phenomenal worldwide free Earl, which you can look at negatively or positively depending on where you stand.
Right.
And I understand and respect that. However, from a awareness and anticipation standpoint, it's a massive part of his story. And he came home and was working with some other people for a while. There were some awkward times, and you know, Earl changed. Earl went to fucking swim with whales and shit. Like, yeah. And thought and figured life out and figured out what, you know, what he wanted to do. And coming home, you know, how weird is that? Your friends are, you know, getting blown, and they got money, and they got their cool kids, and all of a sudden they were the quirky kids, but yeah. Now they're cool, and there's a store, and there's a, like, what the fuck, right? Like, right. And people are stopping him on the street. And
yeah.
So he had to go through his own process of, like, you know, that's heavy.
Right.
Imagine being 17 years old.
I couldn't even imagine.
And trying to fucking grasp, and then trying to keep up, and then, like, how that affects the group, what Earl coming home does to the group. Where does he sign? How does he sign? How do we even deal with this? We were all surfing. We all expected him to come right back into the fold. That process took time, and it eventually, you know, worked itself out. And the truth is, him and Tyler are, to me, they make each other better as artists.
Yeah.
They're completely different. There's a competition, but it's awesome because they're so different. It doesn't matter. It's like, Earl's the fucking lyrical rapper, and Tyler's fucking Tyler. You
right,
know what I mean? Like,
right.
They're both and they're so good at each of their lanes. Like, and again, and so yeah, the process of him coming home, when he did that first show in New York, when he came out, I mean, incredible moments.
Yeah, yeah.
And his friends hugging him, and like, I mean, goddamn, amazing moments.
After you meet the guys, like, how long is it before you realize, like, oh, these are the guys that are going to rejuvenate my love for music?
A month.
Yeah, a month.
Yeah. Because I just kept pulling and it kept working, and things started to line up. And I think we as a unit played masterful chess. You know, I'm not one that, goddamn right, we played good chess. We made smart decisions. Nothing's perfect. The downside is, you know, everything's a malleable. Odd Future's a malleable thing that's constantly changing. But I feel like we made the right decisions to put people in the best situation, and that's constantly changing and will continue to change. But
How long was it until you started calling people and saying, "Hey, this is my new thing, and I'm not working with on anything else currently"?
A couple months.
Yeah.
When I realized that there was just so much to do, because at that point, I think the first thing we did was the Looter Squad deal.
Oh.
That was before.
That was the first thing?
Before the deal. Yeah, which was amazing.
That's
right?
Crazy.
Because that is another thing that says that the labels go, fuck, we need to fuck with these guys. They get a TV show.
Yeah, like, that's crazy.
So that, yeah, Nick Weidenfeld, who worked for Adult Swim, was at the same first Odd Future show I was at.
Was that Low End Theory?
Yes. That was the first time I saw them.
Yeah.
Live.
That's dope. You know, this is Kev's studio, and I go to fucking Low End like every week. And
he's a good guy. Like, dude,
yeah, Kev's great. I was so sad that I was in New York that week, so I missed that first show. Very bummed.
He's
about
been
that.
A part of it. He's been a part of the timeline a little bit. Oh, we've had some cool moments there.
Yeah, I have a great Twitter thing that I remember where I said right after I heard the Earl and shit, and then I saw a video of them getting kicked off stage at a talent show or something, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, Odd Future needs to play at Low End Theory 808, and like. I think Haji and Mike G might have tweeted back like, yo, that's a great idea. And then I started telling Kev, everybody like, yo, you got to fuck with these kids. Our future, they're so tight.
Yeah.
I remember the first time hearing Earl getting played at Low End Theory. I think Elvin might have played it, DJ Nobody or somebody. And I was like, oh, shit, these kids are fucking on their way because the crowd went nuts for it, dude.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Anyways.
It was tight. And it was the first time you see their personalities. Like,
yeah.
You know.
No, it's cool, man. It's been a really cool run, and I've really enjoyed watching it from the outside because I just think there's a lot to be soaked in from it. And you guys have been doing really cool shit, man.
I will say this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ton of great fucking shit coming, and I couldn't be more excited. And it's I couldn't be more grateful. And they're amazing kids. I love them. It's not always perfect.
Yeah.
You know, you go in, it is like a family. There are ups and downs. But I wouldn't trade this shit for anything. They saved me from myself.
That's
that
awesome,
makes
man.
Sense.
Yeah.
Makes Not more sense. Than my wife and child and dog. But outside of that, they saved me from myself.
That's great. Well, man, I appreciate you coming in and taking time from your
cool.
busy schedule. Thank
Go
you
good.
So much.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you want to like shout out your Twitter or anything?
No.
All right. You can Google him, Christian Clancy. He's out here.
I'm not. Yeah. I don't really. It's fine.
I'm going to go through my spiel real quick. It gets awkward at this point.
Go ahead. Do your thing.
My name is Lee. You guys might know me as Intuition. You can follow me on Twitter at It's Intuition. My man behind the boards, Ben Shim, making the shit sound buttery.
Big Ben.
Ben at IM Database, space with two S's. You can follow us as a unit at That's Kinda Neat. YouTube.com/That's Kinda Neat, where you should subscribe and watch all the videos. Facebook.com/kindofneat and download that podcast app and subscribe. Leave 5-star ratings, comment, do all that good stuff. Tell us who you guys want to see on the show. This was my man Christian Clancy. My name's Lee, and that was Kinda Neat.
Sweet.
Thanks, man.
Cool.
That was fucking awesome.
Yeah, I never know.